From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now.
Car le patriotisme est l'exact contraire.
Because patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. Nationalism is its betrayal. By pursuing our own interests first, with no regard to others, we erase the very thing that a nation holds most precious, that which gives it life and makes it great, its moral values.
The 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. That's when World War I ended, 100 years ago this weekend, while world leaders gathered in France to mark Armistice Day. French President Macron rebuked President Trump's nationalist rhetoric. Trump skipped not only the Paris Peace Forum, but a ceremony honoring American soldiers killed in France because it was raining. We speak to the historian Adam Hochschild about this weekend's centennial, the significance of World War I, and the pacifists who refused to fight in the war. Then, to mark Veterans Day, we speak with Suzanne Gordon, author of Wounds of War, how the VA delivers health, healing, and hope to the nation's veterans.
And there is a huge threat to privatize the VA by people like the Koch brothers, by the infamous hedge fund insider trader Stephen Cohen, who's trying to set up an alternative mental health system to compete with the VA. This is a very serious moment for the VA.
We'll also speak with Suzanne Gordon about the Marine veteran who massacred 12 people at a bar holding a country music night for college students in Thousand Oaks, California last week. The gunman served in Afghanistan and may have been suffering from PTSD. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In California, at least 31 people are dead, more than 200 are missing, as three massive wildfires fueled by easterly winds and a historic drought continue to rage. In Northern California's Butte County, the Camp Fire has become the state's deadliest in 85 years after at least 29 people died as the town of Paradise was almost completely destroyed. Recovery workers say some victims were reduced to bone fragments, raising the prospect of a much larger death toll, as some 228 county residents remain unaccounted for. In Southern California, a 250,000 residents of Los Angeles and Ventura counties were ordered to evacuate the Woolsey Fire, including the entire city of Malibu and parts of the San Fernando Valley. The fire tore through oceanside homes as panicked residents sought to escape through a massive traffic jam along the Pacific Coast Highway. The Woolsey Fire began near the Santa Ana Susanna Field Laboratory, site of a partial nuclear meltdown nearly 60 years ago. California's Department of Toxic Substances Control said it did not believe the flames kicked up any radioactive materials. On Sunday, Governor Jerry Brown said the fires were driven by climate change and that California needs to learn to adapt.
We're in a new abnormal, and things like this will be part of our future. And this won't be the beginning. It'll be things like this and worse.
The fires are so large they can be clearly seen from space. Smoke and ash have left millions of Californians exposed to air quality rated as unhealthy or very unhealthy levels, with residents of Los Angeles, Sacramento, and the Bay Area warned against spending time outdoors. President Trump responded to the fires by blaming California officials and threatening to cut off federal aid. Early Saturday morning, he tweeted, "There's no reason for these massive, deadly, and costly forest fires in California except that forest management is so poor. Billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forest. Remedy now or no more Fed payments." Trump's tweet drew outrage from first responders and state officials. California Professional Firefighters President Brian Rice called Trump's tweet ill-informed, ill-timed, and demeaning, adding, quote, "At a time when our every effort should be focused on vanquishing the destructive fires and helping the victims, the president has chosen instead to issue an uninformed political threat aimed squarely at the innocent victims of these cataclysmic fires." Among the Southern California communities evacuated due to the fires was Thousand Oaks, site of last Wednesday's mass shooting by a former Marine who opened fire at a country music bar, killing 12 people. New details about the shooter, Ian Long, have emerged. Former high school track coach says Long assaulted her and screamed profanities at her in high school. She described Long as a ticking time bomb who constantly lost his temper. But her attempts to have Long thrown off the track team were overruled by a senior coach who said that would compromise Long's goal of joining the Marines. Sam Tanner, who later served in the U.S. Marine Corps with Ian Long, told the New York Times, quote, "I'm not surprised someone I knew ended up doing a mass shooting. We had another guy recently committed suicide by cops in Texas. Guys struggle. We've lost more Marines in our peer group to suicide than we ever lost in Afghanistan," he said. About 17 veterans a day kill themselves. We'll speak with Suzanne Gordon, author of Wounds of War, about this later in the broadcast. In Florida, vote recounts in the U.S. Senate and gubernatorial races are underway. In the Senate race, Republican Governor Rick Scott's lead over Democratic incumbent Bill Nelson for Senate has shrunk to just 0.15% in Broward County, Florida's second most populous county. Reports of undervoting have raised concern, with 25,000 more people apparently voting in the governor's race than the Senate race. Some say this could be due to the confusing ballot design or problems with the vote counting machines. In the governor's race, Republican Ron DeSantis is leading Democrat Andrew Gillum by 0.41%. Both President Trump and Republican Governor Rick Scott have claimed, with no evidence, that Democrats are carrying out widespread voter fraud. This is Democrat Andrew Gillum responding to those claims on Sunday from a church in Fort Lauderdale.
The governor has filed another lawsuit to try to keep the votes that were counted in Broward County just yesterday from being added to the total tally. These are legal votes. These are legal votes that have been cast. And we are right now in court fighting to have those votes counted.
Gillum originally conceded his race election night, but has since retracted the concession as his opponent's lead narrowed. Florida's recounts are scheduled to be completed by Thursday. In Arizona, Democrat Kyrsten Sinema has increased her lead over Republican Martha McSally to almost 1.5% in the race to succeed Republican Senator Jeff Flake, but hundreds of thousands of more votes remain to be counted. In the Georgia governor's race, Democrat Stacey Abrams filed a federal lawsuit Sunday calling for rejected absentee and provisional ballots to be counted in a race that's still too close to call. Unofficial voting numbers put Republican Brian Kemp in the lead of 50.3% of the vote. If his lead shrinks to 50% or less, the race will go to a runoff. In Orange County, California, 15-term Republican congressmember, former Reagan speechwriter Dana Rohrabacher, has lost his seat to Democratic challenger Harley Ruda. The Mississippi Senate race will head to a runoff later this month after neither Republican incumbent Cindy Hyde-Smith nor Democratic challenger Mike Espy received the 50% of the vote needed to declare victory. Hyde-Smith is coming under fire for a remark earlier this month during a campaign stop. In a video of the event, she's heard saying, quote, "If he invited me to a public hanging, I'd be in the front row." Hyde-Smith is referring to a local rancher in the video. Her opponent, Mike Espy, is African-American. The FBI is investigating a Florida company where Matt Whitaker, President Trump's pick for acting attorney general, once served as a paid advisory board member. Last year, the Federal Trade Commission shut down the company, World Patent Marketing Incorporated, after a number of inventors, including military veterans, said the company cheated them out of their life savings. Whitaker was paid at least $9,300 to serve on the board of World Patent Marketing and appeared in promotional videos on behalf of the company. As acting attorney general, Whitaker Whitaker will oversee the FBI, which is now investigating Whitaker's former company. The growing scandal came as Democrats questioned whether Trump's appointment of Whitaker is constitutional. They also warned against any interference by the Justice Department in special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. On Friday, Trump was asked if he'd spoken to Matt Whitaker about the Mueller probe before appointing him acting attorney general.
I didn't speak to Matt Whitaker about it. I don't know Matt Whitaker.
President Trump's comment Friday directly contradicted a previous statement he made a month ago. This is Trump speaking on Fox and Friends on October 11th.
I can tell you, Matt Whitaker is a great guy. I mean, I know Matt Whitaker.
Further about whether he hired Whitaker in order to end the Mueller probe, Trump attacked reporters. This is Trump being questioned by CNN's Abby Phillip.
Robert Mueller?
What a stupid question that is. What a stupid question. But I watch you a lot. You ask a lot of stupid questions.
Abby Phillip is one of three prominent black women reporters Trump has attacked in recent days. Last Wednesday, Trump accused PBS reporter Yamiche Alcindor of asking a racist question at a White House news conference after she asked Trump whether he was emboldening white nationalists. Trump went on to attack April Ryan of American Urban Radio Networks, whom Trump repeatedly told to sit down Wednesday as she tried to ask a question about voter suppression.
The same thing with April Ryan. I watch her get up. I mean, you talk about somebody that's a loser. She doesn't know what the hell she's doing. She gets publicity, and then she gets a pay raise, or she gets a contract with, I think, CNN. But she's very nasty, and she shouldn't be.
In more news from the Justice Department, Jeff Sessions signed a last-minute order limiting the use of consent decrees Wednesday, hours before he was fired by President Trump. The order will restrict the ability of law enforcement officials to use court-enforced agreements between the Justice Department and local police departments to enact changes when the police departments have been accused of abuses and civil rights violations. In Paris, President Trump joined world leaders Sunday as they gathered to pay tribute to the millions who died in World War I. On the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended the war. Speaking at a formal ceremony at the Arc de Triomphe, French President Emmanuel Macron warned growing nationalism in countries, including the United States, threatens the world again. After the ceremony, over 70 heads of state attended the Paris Peace Forum. President Trump was reportedly the sole head of state to skip it, returning to the U.S. shortly after it began. Trump also faced widespread criticism for his decision to cancel his visit to a U.S. military cemetery on Saturday because it was raining. After headlines, we'll speak to historian Adam Hochschild, whose article for The New Yorker earlier this month was headlined 100 years after the armistice. In Yemen, aid workers are warning that a U.S.-backed Saudi-led assault on the port city of Hodeidah threatens to cut off supply lines of food and medicine that are desperately needed by millions. The U.N. has called Yemen the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe, with some 14 million people on the brink of famine. Over the weekend, the Saudi coalition intensified its assault on Hodeidah, with reports of at least 149 deaths, including civilians, just in the past 24 hours. This is Dr. Mariam Aldagani of the group Save the Children, speaking from Hodeidah on Friday.
In the last 30 minutes, there were more than 15 airstrikes. 15. I visit today Al Amal Hospital. I saw one child. He's a teenager. He's 15 years old. He's totally paralyzed because before 3 days, he was walking in the street and there is a stray bullet penetrating his neck and cut the spinal cord. He's totally paralyzed.
The New York Times reports top Saudi intelligence officials close to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman considered a $2 billion plan to hire private intelligence operatives to assassinate prominent Iranians. The Times cited three people familiar with discussions about plans to kill Qasem Soleimani, the leader of the Quds Force of Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps. The plan was reportedly discussed at a meeting arranged by George Nader, a Lebanese-American who reportedly pitched the assassination plan to Trump White House officials. officials. In Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, suicide bombers and gunmen attacked a popular hotel Saturday, killing 39 people and wounding 40 others. The militant group al-Shabaab claimed responsibility. The attack came as the Trump administration has stepped up attacks on al-Shabaab with at least 29 airstrikes in Somalia so far this year. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinians say Israeli commandos and a civilian vehicle drove into the southern city of Khan Yunis Sunday in a clandestine raid that killed 7 Hamas members, including a commander. Israel said one of its soldiers had been killed in an exchange of fire before Israel called in tank fire and airstrikes while the commandos escaped back to Israel. After the fighting, Palestinians fired 17 rockets into southern Israel, none of which appear to have caused deaths or injuries. Meanwhile, Israel allowed the government of Qatar to provide millions of dollars in aid to pay the salaries of thousands of Palestinian civil servants who've worked for months without a full paycheck. Israel also allowed a shipment of diesel fuel, also paid for by Qatar, which has reduced the number of hours Gaza residents have spent without electricity. Even with the increased power supply, Gazans have only about 8 hours of electricity per day. And in Oklahoma City, a jury has ordered the insurance giant Aetna to pay over $25 million to the family of a cancer patient who died after she was denied cancer treatment. The jury ruled Aetna acted recklessly in 2014 when three of the company's medical directors decided to deny radiation therapy to Arana Cunningham, who had stage 4 cancer near her brainstem. The directors called the treatment experimental, even though the treatment is covered under Medicare. Arana died in 2015 at the age of 54. Doctors think the treatment denied by Aetna might have dramatically extended her life. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. That's when World War I came to an end 100 years ago this weekend. On Sunday, world leaders gathered in Paris to pay tribute to the dead, marking the anniversary of the armistice of what had been described as the war to end all wars. Between 1914 and 1918, about 10 million civilians perished. Almost 10 million soldiers were killed. Another 21 million wounded. On Sunday, French President Emmanuel Macron used his address at the ceremony to caution against the dangers of nationalism.
This vision of France as a generous nation with a vision which carries universal values has been, in those dark times, exactly the opposite of the selfishness of a people which only looks at its own interests.
Car le patriotisme.
Because patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. Nationalism is its betrayal. By pursuing our own interests first, with no regard to others, we erase the very thing that a nation holds most precious, that which gives it life and makes it great, its moral values.
Macron's comments were widely viewed as a rebuke of President Trump, who's openly described himself as a nationalist. Just before the summit, President Macron also called for formation of a European army. He said, quote, "We have to protect ourselves with respect to China, Russia, and even the United States of America. We need a Europe which defends itself better alone without just depending on the United States in a more sovereign manner." Following the formal ceremony at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel attended a peace conference with nearly 80 heads of state, including Russian President Vladimir Putin and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan. President Trump did not attend the Paris Peace Forum, apparently the sole leader who did not, returning to the United States shortly after it began. Yes, Trump reportedly the only one among 72 leaders to skip the meeting. Trump also faced widespread criticism for his decision to cancel a visit to a U.S. military cemetery in France on Saturday because it was raining. He canceled his visit to pay honor to the U.S. World War I war dead. To find out more about the significance of the war and its commemoration, we go now to Berkeley, California, to talk to Adam Hochschild, lecturer at the Graduate School of Journalism, University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book, published last month, Lessons from a Dark Time and Other Essays. His article for The New Yorker earlier this month headlined 100 Years After Armistice. His other books include To End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion, 1914 to 1918, King Leopold's Ghost as well. Adam Hochschild was a co-founder of Mother Jones Magazine. Adam, welcome back to Democracy Now! First, share your response to what took place this weekend on the centennial of World War I.
Hi, Amy. It's always good to be with you. I think my main feeling was disappointment, not for the first time, with how President Trump responded to this extraordinary anniversary. Here we are exactly yesterday, 100 years to the day after this terrible war ended. And President Macron of France at least wanted to use the anniversary to bring together world leaders to talk about peace and to talk about how wars like this could be averted in the future. And instead, Trump ignored that, just went through a very perfunctory paying respects to the American dead, not the ones that he would have had to visit in the rain, but others, and then turned around and went home. I think the lesson that we ought to take from looking back at the First World War is that wars break out very easily. People always think of starting a war as going to solve a problem. It usually creates all sorts of other problems instead. Look at what's happened with the United States ventures in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And an anniversary like this is a time for sitting down, thinking about that, talking about that, not turning your back on other world leaders and rushing home.
Quite something. President Trump, on Saturday, while other world leaders visited the cemeteries of their war dead, President Trump, though it was completely planned, he said, because of the rain, he wasn't going to the cemetery where how many soldiers, I think over 1,000, perhaps 2,000 American soldiers were buried. If you can talk about who these soldiers are who died in World War One.
Well, these were men who volunteered and men who were drafted and who went to Europe in the last months of the war. The United States, you know, World War One lasted for 4.5 years, from the summer of 1914 until November 11th, 1918. For the first 2.5 of those years, the United States was officially neutral, even though it was selling huge amounts of arms and armaments and ammunition and so forth to the Allied countries, Britain and France above all. But the U.S. was not involved in the fighting. Then the United States joined in the spring of 1917. It took really a little more than a year to get large numbers of American troops sufficiently trained. But starting in the summer of 1918, huge numbers of Americans, young Americans, went to France very eager to fight, as young men so often and so tragically are all over the world. In fact, when those U.S. troops got to France, many of the men assigned to rear areas began to do what the military called deserting to the front. They had come to Europe to fight and to see glory in battle and not to be loading supplies in the rear somewhere. So by the end of the war, there were some 2 million American troops in France, and they certainly supplied an important ingredient in the forces that brought the Allied armies to victory. They were fresh and raring to go, unlike the soldiers of the countries that had already been fighting in Europe for more than 4 years. Roughly a little over 100,000 Americans perished in that war, about half of them in combat and the other half from the great influenza epidemic that swept through the world at that time, killing a huge number of people. But that flu epidemic was closely related to the war because it was first medically noticed on a U.S. Army base in Kansas. And as American troops went to Europe, they carried the flu with them, and then it spread very rapidly through European countries as well. And of course, any kind of disease like that spreads even faster when the people who are suffering from it are in close confinement with lots of others in places like troop ships, army barracks, trenches, and so forth.
I wanted to ask you about both French President Macron's comments, clearly alluding to President Trump calling himself a nationalist and saying nationalism is the opposite of patriotism, Macron said. In another apparent rebuke to Trump's policies, German Chancellor Angela Merkel warned of the dangers of isolationism.
Der Erste Weltkrieg hat uns gezeigt.
The First World War shows how isolationism leads to many destructions, and if isolationism wasn't the right solution more than 100 years ago, how could it simply be the right choice today? In an interconnected world that has five times more people as today, shaping an interconnected world, this was the model of our German G20 presidency last year for this very reason.
Adam Hochschild, your response.
Well, you know, I liked President Macron's remarks about the difference between patriotism and nationalism. I think it's an important distinction. You know, the nationalist always thinks, my country first, my country above all. Patriotism, by his definition, I think means something subtle and more and different. It actually reminded me of something which 100 years ago, someone quite different said about patriotism. I'm thinking about Emma Goldman, the great anarchist leader, who was one of many Americans who resisted the war and was punished for it. Goldman was sentenced to 2 years in prison for organizing against the draft. And at her trial, she was accused by the prosecution of being unpatriotic. And she replied this way. I'll just read you what she wrote. Gentlemen of the jury, she asked, and of course in those days juries were all gentlemen, no ladies, may there not be different kinds of patriotism as there are different kinds of liberty? And her patriotism, she explained, was like that, and these are her words, of the man who loves a woman with open eyes. He is enchanted by her beauty, yet he sees her faults. I think that's a pretty good definition of patriotism, where you can love your country, but you are not blind to its faults. And when you see your country doing something that you think is wrong, such as joining a war that it has no business being in, you have every right to speak out. So my main feeling about this 100th anniversary of this terrible war is that we should be honoring people like Emma Goldman, like Eugene Debs, like the social worker Jane Addams, just to speak about Americans, who saw the war as madness when it was going on, did everything they could to bring it to a stop. You know, they were patriots also.
Talk about Jane Addams, Eugene Debs, and others, the heart of your book, To End All Wars.
Well, one of the things, you know, when we look back at the First World War, I think at this point, most of us would agree that if there was any one single event in the 20th century that we could reach back and magically undo, wouldn't it be the War of 1914 to 1918? Not only did it produce a colossal death toll, but it left behind a legacy of bitterness and resentment in Germany that Hitler was able to manipulate so cleverly to gain power and start an even more destructive war and the Holocaust as well. I think it's impossible to imagine the Second World War happening without the First. Well, at the time it was happening, 1914 to 1918, there were in all of the warring countries extraordinary people who saw what was happening as madness and who often refused to fight if they were young men eligible for the military, or who supported those who refused to fight. Emma Goldman, as I mentioned, was sent to jail for organizing against the draft and speaking out very strongly against the war. Eugene Debs, the great labor leader, spoke out against the war after the United States entered it, and for that he was sentenced to prison. And he was still in prison in November of 1920 when he received nearly a million votes for president on the Socialist Party ticket, being able to campaign only from his prison cell. Jane Addams, the pioneer social worker, also was a strong opponent of the war, and she took part in a remarkable conference of women from warring countries on both sides and from neutral nations who met in The Hague in neutral Holland in 1915 to try to talk about ways of making peace. And the photographs from that conference are one of the few places, if not the only place, where during those 4.5 years you can see people from both sides embracing each other, talking together, trying to figure out how to stop this horrible conflict. There were brave war resistors in every other country. In France, for example, someone I hope they have been honoring this past week, although I haven't seen anything about it, is the great French socialist leader Jean Jaurès, who in 1914 spoke out very strongly against this war he saw looming, saw it coming. A week before it started, he rushed to Brussels for an emergency conference of the leaders of Europe's left-wing parties. Before an enormous crowd in a plaza there, he put his arm around the leader of the German Social Democrats and said, you know, our people will never make war on each other. Because of that, 3 days later, after he had gone back to France, he was assassinated. 3 days after that, the war began. His assassin, incidentally, was found innocent at his trial because the crime was judged to be, quotes, a crime of passion. A legal gimmick that usually lets men get away with murdering women, but in this case it was put to a different use. There were, you know, more than 6,000 people in England, young men in England who were eligible for the draft, who refused it, and who were sent to prison because of that. There were war resistors in Germany, like Rosa Luxemburg, the great democratically minded socialist, sent to prison for her opposition to the war. More such people in Russia. So from all of these countries, I think these are the people, as well as the veterans, who should be honored at this point.
On Wednesday, French President Emmanuel Macron stirred controversy when he suggested that he would honor Marshal Philippe Pétain, along with seven other marshals, as part of Armistice Day commemorations this weekend. During the Second World War, Pétain collaborated with the Nazis in the deportation of Jews from France. After the Second World War came to an end, he was convicted and jailed for treason. Macron clarified his remarks Thursday.
I'm looking at history as it is, and as I've said yesterday, there's one Marshal Pétain, who was one of the figures and one of the great soldiers of World War I. No one can erase that. So now I simply said you can't erase history. We are not the judges of history, but there was never any question of him receiving an individual commemoration. And so what I've always said and wanted to do and to be done is for the army marshals to be remembered and for there to be no individual commemoration for Pétain, as has been the case since former President Jacques Chirac's time.
Adam Hochschild, if you could talk about Pétain and the role he played from World War I to World War II, and how you believe World War I, the way it ended, led to World War II.
Right. Well, Pétain was sort of an odd case because he was a great military hero in World War I, and then in World War II, he, of course, became the leader of the French regime that collaborated with the German occupiers, most notoriously in assisting them in rounding up the Jews of France and Jews from other countries who had tried to take refuge in France and shipping them off to the death camps. So a very controversial figure and a strange person to pick to honor. In the First World War, one reason that Pétain was a military hero was that he suppressed successfully a widespread mutiny in the French army. In 1917, tens of thousands of French soldiers refused orders to take part in new attacks. They had just been through a fruitless offensive where some 30,000 French soldiers were killed. One of these typical World War I attacks where soldiers were ordered to climb out of their trenches and and advance into machine gun fire and just get mowed down by the thousands. Mutinies spread through the French army. Soldiers refused to attack. One group of soldiers hijacked a train and tried to drive it back to Paris. Other soldiers said, we're not going to leave our trenches, but we will be here to defend France, but we're not going to take part in any attacks. This was the greatest such catastrophe to hit the Allied armies in the West, and Pétain was brought in and, with a mixture of carrot and stick, managed to suppress the mutinies. He had some mutineers shot. Many others were sentenced to death, and then he reprieved their sentences, so they felt grateful to him to be able to be allowed to live. He improved the food sent to the army. He granted people leave on a more regular basis, and basically things got calmed down, although the French army did make no more of those absolutely suicidal attacks. So that was... That was really his role. Your other question, Amy, was about how the First World War led to the Second, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, there were a couple of peculiar things about the way the First World War ended. I think there's no way it could have ended well when you had so many people killed. You know, Germany lost 1.8 million soldiers killed, France 1.4 million, Britain 750,000, you know, close to 2 million in Russia. Every nation felt deeply bloodied and deeply wounded, hurt, losing all these sons, husbands, brothers. And there were many civilian casualties as well. But one peculiar thing about how the war ended was that because of the tightly controlled propaganda apparatus, especially on the German side, the German people in the last months of the war really had no idea that their army was losing. It was easy not to realize that because the fighting was still taking place almost entirely outside of Germany. The German army, even though it had retreated a couple of hundred miles, it was still in France and Belgium by November of 1918. On the Eastern Front in Russia, Germany and Russia had made a peace deal, and Germany now occupied a huge swath of what was then the Russian Empire, is today Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltic states. So Germans felt, you know, there's no fighting on our home territory. We haven't been told anything about defeats or anything. Why is there suddenly an armistice? And then the terms of the armistice became clear immediately that Germany had to retreat from all this land it occupied. And furthermore, there were going to be reparations and Allied troops were going to be occupying part of Germany. The Rhineland, the area of Germany on either side, particularly on the western side of the Rhine River. So that set things up for the legend of the stab in the back, the belief that the right wing in Germany encouraged very strongly that their army had been poised for victory in this great and terrible war, and then it was stabbed in the back by Jews, socialists, communists, pacifists. And even before Hitler began talking this way, there were right-wingers in Germany who were already muttering along these lines in the last months of the war because they knew that their military was losing, which the general public did not know. They needed to have somebody to blame, and the German high command helped ensure that it would be a socialist government in the last days that would have to take the blame for signing the peace agreement, the armistice. The armistice was really a German surrender, and whatever government signed that was going to be blamed for losing the war. The high command didn't even send particularly senior military representatives to the signing ceremony because they didn't want any photographs of the key generals there. They sent a naval captain and a major general, which is rather low-ranking, and it was a civilian cabinet minister who led the delegation that signed that peace agreement. So that kind of set things up for a German public that was astonished to find out that they had lost the war, was ready to be told that somebody was to blame for this. And this really paved the way for Hitler. There was another part of that armistice agreement also that created an enormous amount of ill will, which was this. Throughout the war, Germany had been under a tight naval blockade. The British Navy controlled the seas, and their ships surrounded Germany and its ally, Austria-Hungary, so that no foreign ships could get through. This created a great deal of hunger because Germany, on the eve of the war, had imported a quarter of its food. And then once the fighting started, its production of food, its homegrown food, greatly diminished because the young men who would normally be tilling the fields and herding the cattle and so forth were all off at the front being killed. So Germany quickly ran short of food. The population was on the edge of famine for much of the war. It's estimated by scholars that more than 400,000 Germans died of malnutrition. The average German lost 10 to 20% of their body weight during the war. There are statistics on children's growth during that period that shows the average German child of any given age in 1918 was an inch shorter than the average German child of any given age in 1914. So Germans suffered terribly from this food blockade and then were horrified to find that when the armistice was signed, it provided that the blockade would continue until Germany signed a final peace treaty. And everybody knew that was months off, and indeed, it didn't happen until nearly 8 months later when the Treaty of Versailles was signed. So Germany had to continue to endure this wartime starvation for months after the armistice. And in that article I wrote, I quote the American journalist Oswald Garrison Villard, writing from Germany 4 months after the armistice and talking about how little food people have to eat. He visits one hospital where all they have to give their patients of any sort is just a carrot soup, nothing else. And he talks about how now I'm hearing a kind of bitterness in the air that I didn't hear a couple of months ago when I first got here.
Adam, we only have a minute to go, but what lessons can we learn today from World War One?
A couple, I think, Amy. One is that wars almost always cause more problems than they solve. Everybody thinks that starting a war is going to solve a particular problem. We're going to get some tyrant out of power. We're going to punish a country for doing this or that. And then, you know, 10, 15, 20 years later, you find yourself dealing with consequences that you never anticipated. And I think that was the case with World War One, where it led to a second, even more destructive war and the Holocaust as well. That's the lesson of the U.S. war in Iraq, for example, where we know today that ISIS began to form in the prison camps of that war when Islamic militants came together with veterans of Saddam Hussein's army. So I think long and hard before starting a new war. Anybody at any time should take that lesson from this first of the terrible wars of the 20th century.
And particularly what President Trump should learn?
In particular, I think he should learn that any wars he might contemplate, and it's a little hard to figure out what they might be, but he's made all sorts of threatening noises against the Chinese, against the Iranians, previously against the North Koreans, and possibly again against the North Koreans, because he and Kim seem to be falling out of love at this point, that, you know, to carry any of those threats farther into war is almost certain to be a disaster. It's hard to imagine any military conflict with any of those countries ending up well and not causing more problems than it solves.
Adam Hochschild, I want to thank you for being with us, author of To End All Wars, a story of loyalty and rebellion, 1914 to 1918, now lecturer at Graduate School of Journalism, University of California, Berkeley, where he's speaking to us from today. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, it's Veterans Day. We'll speak with Suzanne Gordon, Wounds of War, how the VA delivers health, healing, and hope to the nation's veterans. And we'll also talk about the Marine Corps vet who gunned down 12 people at a country music bar in Thousand Oaks last week. Stay with us. Angelica Jo performing Sunday at the Paris ceremony marking the armistice that ended World War I. The song was written by Belle Bleu of Togo, a former French colony. It honors the memory of African soldiers who died in the war over a century ago. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to this federal observance of Veterans Day, to the issue of veterans' health care, on Sunday, Vice President Mike Pence wrote an article for Fox News titled, "Veterans Have No Better Friend Than President Trump." Pence touted Trump's record on veterans' health, writing, "President Trump has signed the most substantial veterans' health care reform in a generation, making veterans' choice a permanent part of American law. Today, our veterans have access to the real-time, world-class care they've earned, whether at a private health care provider or the Department of Veterans Affairs. This law will also improve the VA's ability to recruit and retain quality health care professionals, give veterans access to walk-in care, and expand health care choices, including options for telehealth and mental health services," the vice president wrote. Critics of the law say it's an attempt to drain the Veterans Health Administration of needed resources, eventually forcing the privatization of the system. Meanwhile, the issue of veterans' mental health was raised again last week after a former Marine opened fire at a country music bar last week in Thousand Oaks, California, killing 12 people, mostly college students. Police have identified the gunman as 28-year-old Ian David Long, a Marine veteran who deployed to Afghanistan and had a history of mental health issues, including possibly PTSD. Sam Tanner, who served in the U.S. Marine Corps with Ian Long, told the New York Times, quote, "I'm not surprised someone I knew ended up doing a mass shooting. We had another guy recently committed suicide by cops in Texas. Guys struggle. We've lost more Marines in our peer group to suicide than we ever lost in Afghanistan," he said. Earlier this year, Long was evaluated by mental health professionals after police responded to a disturbance at his home where he lived with his mother, but he was cleared by the specialists. Clearly, his neighbors said his mother was afraid of him. For more, we're joined by award-winning journalist and author Suzanne Gordon. Her new book, Wounds of War, How the VA Delivers Health, Healing, and Hope to the Nation's Veterans. She recently wrote an article for the New York Times headlined, "By Protecting Veterans' Health, You May Protect Your Own." Welcome to Democracy Now!, Suzanne. You wrote this piece, "By Protecting Veterans' Health, You May Protect Your Own." Explain.
Well, the Veterans Health Administration doesn't just care for veterans and give innovative, state-of-the-art care to the nation's military veterans. It also conducts research, the shingles vaccine, the nicotine patch, the first liver transplant that helps all Americans. I thank the VA for my shingles vaccine, for example. It also teaches about 70% of American physicians in training. It teaches nurses, psychologists, social workers, and it develops models of clinical care that really help us all. I mean, I've never seen teamwork practice so thoroughly as I have in VA hospitals, and I've been covering private sector health care for almost 35 years. The end-of-life care and palliative care it gives to patients with cancer and other of diseases that will end up in their deaths is really amazing. The VA practically invented the field of geriatrics. I mean, I live in Northern California, and Kaiser, which is a system that is very close to the VA but nowhere near as good as it, in my view, has a handful, if any, geriatricians to deal with an aging population. So the VA continues to innovate. I mean, right now they're doing a million veteran program in order to look at the impact of genes on health. They're developing ways of dealing with demented patients that are angry and aggressive and unable to be transferred to nursing homes. I watched one program where a World War II veteran was terrified when they opened the window shade because he thought, speaking of the armistice, he thought that the Nazis were coming in the window, and they taught the nurses and the aides how to deal with this veteran without using any kind of restraints, and were able finally to get him into a nursing home. And they had calmed him down so much that when I walked in the room one day after seeing him the other day in a very agitated state, he came up to me and he asked me how I was and kissed my hand.
Can you talk about Pence's statement about President Trump signing the most substantial veterans health care reform in a generation, making veterans' choice a permanent part of American law? What is this about?
So this is—he's referring to the VA Mission Act of 2018, which was passed in June. Sadly, too many Democrats also voted for this act. This act definitely is a big change, and what it will do is not make veterans healthier or really help them to deal with the many different wounds of war and of military service that they suffer from. It's going to starve the VA of resources. I mean, it allows many more veterans to go into private sector hospitals and doctors and mental health providers and so forth, who various studies show are not familiar with their many very specific problems. Every dollar that is paid to the private sector will come out of the VHA budget, the Veterans Health Administration budget. So pretty soon what we'll see is there will be more money going to private sector doctors and hospitals that are not equipped to take care of veterans' problems. And money will be taken right out of the VHA budget. And that what you'll see then is facility closures, layoffs, service cuts, et cetera. And you may even see, because this is going to be so expensive, because private sector care is 2 to 3 times more expensive than VA care. I mean, Veterans Health Administration physicians and other staff are on salary. So they have no incentive to overtreat. They have no incentive to duplicate tests. They have no incentive to order other tests that aren't necessary. And so the costs are going to rise. And I think what we're going to see is that there will be cuts in eligibility in which veterans are eligible for this care and cuts in which services they're eligible for. And this is the veteran, it's called the VA Mission Act. And I think it's all about killing the mission of the VA, which is to give high quality care to the kind of veterans that come back from war with serious problems, like Adam Hochschild described in the earlier segment, and the kind of mental health and pain problems and other problems that so many veterans suffer from.
Suzanne Gordon, we're going to just break for 30 seconds, then come back. And I want to ask you about Ian Long, the alleged shooter in the Thousand Oaks case, who gunned down 12 people, mainly yes. college kids. He's a Marine Corps vet. Stay with us.
Thank you.
That's Yo-Yo Ma performing Bach Suite No. 5 for cello and C minor at Sunday's ceremony in Paris, marking 100 years since the armistice that ended World War I. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The issue of veterans' mental health raised again last week after a former Marine opened fire at a country music bar in Thousand Oaks, California, killing 12 people, mostly college students. Police have identified him as 28-year-old Ian David Long, a Marine vet who deployed to Afghanistan, had a history of mental health issues, including possibly PTSD. Suzanne Gordon's still with us. Her new book, Wounds of War, How the VA Delivers Health, Healing, and Hope to the Nation's Veterans. Suzanne, we don't know that much about Ian Long, but we know some things, like the police went to his house. He lives with his mother. His mother was afraid of him. They had mental health professionals assess him, but they didn't do anything more than that at the time. He goes into this bar that apparently he frequented, and he guns 12 people down. Last week, at a yoga studio in Tallahassee, Florida, another young man, young white man, who is a military veteran, blows away two women, a 61-year-old doctor and a student at Florida State. Can you talk about your response to this and looking at veterans coming home?
So I think we have to be very careful, Amy, not to label every veteran who comes home with a mental health problem as a danger to other people. We have had three instances this year. There was also the tragic murder and homicide and suicide of a veteran in Yountville, California, who killed three women who led the Pathway Home program. I think that the lesson of many of these shootings is that you have to be very careful who you accept into the military and train to use arms. Ian Long apparently had problems before he was accepted into the military.